Brand new single from Detroit, Michigan's own Popular Creeps here on the Viva La Mock radio program. The song is called Split Decision. And before that, some newer music from Dolph Cheney from his This Is Dolph Cheney album, And I Wanted You. Speaking of newer music, how about brand spanking new music from the Armoires? Yeah. That was them, if you noticed, doing a John Cale cover, Paris 1919, from an album that was literally released on April 1st. Talk about brand new. Now, let me tell you some fun things about this album. The album's called Incognito, and the reason is because it was released on April 1st, but back in October, the Armoires started releasing music, but they were doing it under pseudonyms. So they're like, okay, we're going to take Halloween, where you dress up and you mask yourself as something else, all the way up until April Fool's Day and put out songs. So literally that version, that song came out back in October under the name of October Surprise, but it was actually the Armoires doing the John Cale cover. Brand new disc, more covers on there, more originals. You'll be hearing a lot more of that on future Viva La Mock radio programs. And I start out the entire set with Rex Daisy doing their cover of John Sebastian's theme from Welcome Back, Cotter. Welcome back. Woo! Welcome back, Mockster. Got a couple minutes before we get to the top of the hour. Some things I should tell you is whenever I think of Popular Creeps, I think of my rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. Because he's got a popular radio show. That's where I'm going with it. It's called Courts in Session. It's 2.5 hours of rock and roll. It's country. It's soul. But he focuses on new music by your favorite classic artists. And again, that's Thursdays starting at 8 o'clock. Now, I've got the inside scoop that this Thursday, Albert Bouchard of Blueish Occult fame is going to join him again. He's been on the program before, but he's joining him again this week. I think, I don't know, maybe he's got a new album out, maybe he's got a concert coming up. I don't know, but the only way to know is to tune in Thursday at 8 and find out what's going on.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! what you do. You walk in and you just say, you want to quit? They go on strike. I won't mention the name of the company, but they go on strike and you say, that's okay. You're all gone. You're all gone.
United Auto Workers files federal labor charges against Donald Trump and Elon Musk, accusing them of illegally threatening to fire striking workers during their discussion on Musk's social media platform X. We'll speak with Wall Street Journal reporter Dana Mattioli about how Musk broke with the Democrats to support Trump and is now spending tens of millions of dollars on his run for the presidency. Then the prominent Bethlehem Palestinian pastor, Reverend Munther Isaac.
A genocide has been normalized. And as people of faith, if we truly claim to follow a crucified Savior, we can never be okay with this. We should never accept the normalization of a genocide.
The Reverend Munther Isaac is here in New York speaking tonight at the historic Riverside Church. His address, silence is complicity. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has issued new evacuation orders for tens of thousands of Palestinians sheltering in Khan Yunis. The latest mass displacement order came as the United Nations warned 84% of the Gaza Strip is under evacuation orders issued by the Israeli army. Earlier today, Israeli assaults across Gaza killed at least 20 Palestinians. This comes as Haaretz is reporting the Israeli army has forced Palestinian civilians to inspect potentially booby-trapped tunnels in Gaza. The use of human shields is forbidden under the Geneva Conventions. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed four Palestinians in an airstrike on the town of Tamun earlier today. Soldiers were filmed seizing the corpses, part of an Israeli military practice of withholding the bodies of Palestinians it kills. A fifth Palestinian was killed during an early morning Israeli raid on the town of Tubas. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned Israel's attack on a UN-run school in Gaza City that killed at least 100 people Saturday was far from an isolated incident. The UN reports it's at least the 21st Israeli strike on a school since early July that have killed scores of civilians, including children. On Tuesday, Algeria called an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss Israeli attacks on civilians. Riyad Mansour is Palestine's UN ambassador.
Tragically, this is far from an isolated incident. Indeed, such attacks appear to be occurring with increasing frequency. According to OHCHR, this is at least the 21st strike on a school that has been serving as a shelter recorded since 4 July this year. Scores of people have been killed in these strikes, among them women and children.
This is Palestine's UN ambassador, Riyad Mansour.
You have a responsibility to react, to save human lives and preserve the foundations for peace and security for all, not just for some. Israel is a rogue state with a rotten government due to the unbridled impunity it has enjoyed so far.
The United States has approved $20 billion in additional weapons sales to Israel, despite federal laws that prohibit arms transfers to military units accused of gross human rights violations. The State Department's approval of the sales came just a day after Secretary of State Antony Blinken commemorated the 75th anniversary of the signing of the Geneva Conventions with a call to respect international humanitarian law. Michigan Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, who's Palestinian-American, wrote in reply, quote, "You supported sending more U.S.-made bombs being used to commit war crimes. The government of Israel bombed hospitals, schools, and tents full of displaced Palestinians. How can you say you are for respecting international human rights laws?" Tlaib asked. Peace negotiations aimed at ending Sudan's 16-month war are expected to begin in Geneva today, despite the Sudanese army's refusal to attend the talks mediated by the United States. Sudanese army officials said they would not show up, accusing the Rapid Support Forces of violating an agreement between the warring parties brokered in Saudi Arabia last year, and also criticized the presence of the United Arab Emirates, which it accuses of backing the RSF, as one of the observers in the Geneva negotiations. This comes as the International Organization for Migration warns Sudan is at a breaking point as famine has worsened an already catastrophic displacement crisis. Massive floods across Sudan since June have also compounded the mass displacement. The IOM has called on an urgent global response to the situation in Sudan and increased access to humanitarian aid to prevent tens of thousands of more deaths in the coming months. A second region of Russia has declared a state of emergency after Ukrainian forces pushed deeper into Russian territory in a surprise offensive. The governor of Russia's Belgorod region says Ukrainian drone and artillery attacks have destroyed homes and killed civilians, adding to attacks in Russia's Kursk region that began last week. Almost 200,000 Russians have fled their homes. Meanwhile, the government of Poland says it's been unable to execute an arrest warrant issued by Germany for a suspect in the 2022 sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, which were built to carry natural gas from Russia to Europe. The pipelines were severely damaged in a series of underwater explosions in the Baltic Sea that the United States initially blamed on Russia. A 44-year-old Ukrainian diving professional identified as Volodymyr Z is alleged to have attached explosive charges to the pipelines with two other Ukrainian nationals. Polish authorities say the suspect fled to Ukraine in July. Bangladeshi authorities have opened a murder investigation into the possible role of ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in the police killing of a grocery store owner during mass student-led protests in July. Hasina resigned earlier this month and fled to India. The murder complaint is the first legal case filed against Hasina's deadly crackdown on the weeks-long protests in which Bangladeshi armed forces killed at least 300 protesters, including children, according to the UN. To see our coverage of Bangladesh, go to democracynow.org. Thailand's Constitutional Court has removed the Prime Minister, Srettha Thevisin, from office, ruling he violated the Constitution by appointing a minister to his government who had a criminal conviction and served 6 months in jail in 2008. The move has plunged Thailand into new political turmoil and comes just days after the same court dissolved the Progressive Move Forward opposition party. Thevisin's removal after less than a year in power means that Thai parliament must now convene to form a new government. Thevisin, a real estate tycoon, is the fourth Thai prime minister in 16 years to be removed by the Constitutional Court. The Africa Centers for Disease Control has declared a public health emergency as a virulent strain of Mpox spreads rapidly across Central Africa. So far this year, the Africa CDC has logged over 15,000 suspected cases of the viral disease, formerly known as monkeypox, which can cause fever, rashes, and extremely painful lesions. It's most often spread through close, intimate physical contact. Scientists say the new strain of Mpox is more lethal, with a fatality rate of around 5% in adults and double that in children. Jean Kaseya is director general of the Africa CDC.
This is not just an African issue. Mpox is a global threat, a menace that knows no boundaries, no race, no creed. It is a virus that exploits our vulnerabilities, preying on our weakest point.
In May, the Africa CDC said it was struggling to secure any of the millions of doses of Mpox vaccine it requested from pharmaceutical companies. The World Health Organization's meeting today to consider whether to declare a global public health emergency from Mpox. Here in the United States, at least 27 states are reporting very high levels of coronavirus in wastewater samples, with a four-fold increase since June 1st, driving a summer surge of COVID-19. The United Auto Workers Union has filed federal labor charges against former President Trump and billionaire Tesla CEO Elon Musk after the pair advocated for the illegal firing of striking workers. On Monday, Musk was heard laughing in agreement as Trump made these remarks during an audio live stream on Musk's social media site X, formerly known as Twitter.
Well, you're the greatest cutter. I mean, I look at what you do. You walk in and you just say, You want to quit? They go on strike. I won't mention the name of the company, but they go on strike and you say, that's okay, you're all gone.
The UAW reiterated in a statement that under federal law, workers cannot be fired for going on strike, and threatening to do so is illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. Meanwhile, the campaign reform group End Citizens United has filed a separate complaint with the Federal Election Commission, arguing Musk's softball interview with Trump amounted to an unlawful corporate contribution to Trump's presidential campaign. We'll have more on Elon Musk's embrace of Donald Trump after headlines. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has made his first solo campaign appearance since he was tapped as the Democratic Party's vice presidential nominee. On Tuesday, Walz spoke to public sector union members at AFSCME's annual conference in Los Angeles, drawing a stark contrast between a future Harris administration and one led by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
The only thing those two guys knows about working people is how to work to take advantage of them. That's what they know about it. Every single chance they've gotten, they've waged war on workers, and their ability to collectively bargain to take that away from them. All we're asking for is better wages, better benefits, better lives, and dignity in the work that we do.
Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has fended off a primary election challenge after pro-Israel groups raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to bankroll her opponent's campaign. On Tuesday, Omar defeated former Minneapolis City Councilmember Don Samuels, capturing more than 56% of the vote in the Democratic primary. Omar has been a fierce critic of Israel's war on Gaza and for months has led calls for a ceasefire. Ahead of the primary, Congressmember Omar said in a statement, quote, "It is shameful that my opponent is actively courting Republican votes and desperately seeking funding from AIPAC," unquote. Omar's primary victory came after the powerful American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and its super PAC poured more than $25 million into defeating two black progressive Democrats of the squad, Congressmembers Cori Bush of Missouri and Jamal Bowman of New York. Voters in Arizona and Missouri will decide in November the fate of two ballot measures that would enshrine abortion access in their state constitutions. Missouri's amendment would reverse the state's near-total ban on abortions, which went into effect after the Supreme Court's ruling that gutted Roe v. Wade in 2022. Meanwhile, the Arizona measure would amend the state constitution to protect abortion rights up to 24 weeks of pregnancy. At least five other states, including Florida, Nevada, and South Dakota, will vote on similar measures this November. A warning to our audience, our next story contains disturbing footage and accounts of police violence. In Ohio, a grand jury's indicted a Franklin County police officer on murder and manslaughter charges after he fatally shot a pregnant black mother in a Kroger parking lot over a shoplifting accusation. Body camera video of the killing last August shows Officer Connor Grubb pulled his gun and fired a single shot through the windshield of a car being driven by 21-year-old Takiyah Young, who posed no threat to the officers. Sean Walton is an attorney for Takiyah Young's family.
The actions that led to the death of Takiyah, the unnecessary aggression, the chilling commands that amounted to comply or die, were there for us all to witness in dreadful clarity. Takiyah's life and that of her daughter were extinguished in an act of brutality, becoming yet another symbol of the urgent need for reform in police conduct and accountability.
Authorities have opened an investigation into an online harassment lawsuit brought by the Algerian Olympic boxing gold medalist Iman Khalif. She was targeted by a torrent of misogynist, racist and sexist attacks over her gender eligibility to participate in the 2024 Paris Olympics. False claims and hate speech that Khalif was transgender or a man were posted online, including by tech billionaire Elon Musk and author J.K. Rowling, who are both named in Khalif's lawsuit. Though not named in the complaint, Khalif's lawyer said Donald Trump could also potentially be investigated over his social media remarks about the athlete. Most of the attacks came from X, formerly Twitter, which is owned by Elon Musk. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at how Elon Musk broke with the Democrats to support Donald Trump and is now spending tens of millions of dollars to help Trump get elected. Stay with us. Log Perch by Isaac Howell. From the Stop MVP compilation to Stop the Mountain Valley Pipeline, all proceeds go to the Appalachian Legal Defense Fund. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Auto Workers has filed federal labor charges against Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and billionaire Tesla CEO Elon Musk. The union accuses the men of illegally attempting to threaten and intimidate workers who go on strike. The UAW's complaint with the National Labor Relations Board comes in response to these comments made by Trump during a discussion with Musk Monday on the social media platform X, which Musk owns.
You're the greatest cutter. I mean, I look at what you do. You walk in and you just say, you want to quit? They go on strike. I won't mention the name of the company, but they go on strike and you say, that's okay, you're all gone. You're all gone. So every one of you is gone and you are the greatest. You would be very good. Oh, you would love it.
On Tuesday, UAW President Sean Fain spoke to CBS about why the union filed federal labor charges against Trump and Musk.
This is the problem in America right now. The rich keep getting richer at the expense of the working class. And people like Donald Trump and Elon Musk, they sneer at labor law, but they don't care about labor law because they don't care about working class people. You know, they believe in buying off the system and buying off politicians and being able to have their way with people. And, you know, look, employers need to be held accountable in this country when they break the law. It is a federal right of workers to go on strike, and they cannot be fired for that. But, you know, people like Donald Trump and Elon Musk, they laugh about firing people because they can care less about people and about their jobs and what they do to their careers. All they care about is the billionaire buddies and taking more wealth. And so this is a which side are you on election. And that's why working class people will vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, because they're one of us. And Donald Trump and Elon Musk represent everything that this nation stands against.
While the UAW has endorsed Kamala Harris, Elon Musk is funding a new political action committee to help elect Donald Trump. There have been reports Musk was planning to spend $45 million a month to help elect Trump, but Musk has disputed that figure. We're joined now in Boston by Wall Street Journal reporter Dana Mattioli. She recently co-wrote an article headlined, Inside Elon Musk's Hands-on Push to Win 800,000 Voters for Trump. She's the author of the new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but let's start with Elon Musk and your latest reporting, Dana. Before we talk about the UAW filing a complaint with the NLRB, let's talk about what Elon Musk's role is in Donald Trump's campaign for president.
It's really fascinating. As early as a few months ago, Elon Musk said he would not be contributing any money to either presidential candidate. And what we've seen is a complete 180. Not only did he start this super PAC with lots of money to help Donald Trump win, he is really taking on the get out the vote aspect of the Trump campaign. He also had a big endorsement for Donald Trump after the assassination attempt. So he's become like a very big political player this presidential cycle. In addition to running six companies that he's involved in, this is a person with a very big microphone. The Super PAC is looking to get 800,000 low propensity voters in swing states to the polls for Donald Trump. Elon also wants his workers in those states to register new voters to get them for the polls. But it's had a bit of disruption in the last few weeks because he signed off on firing a lot of their vendors.
Firing the vendors, which, of course, firing was what Donald Trump was praising his ability to do in that conversation he had with Elon Musk on X. But talk more about why he broke with the Democrats and joined Donald Trump in his effort to become president.
Yeah, it's sort of this remarkable political transformation. You know, as of a few years ago, Musk has said that he exclusively voted for Democrats. He voted for Obama. He was pretty close to President Obama. And he voted for Democrats up and down the ticket. What has happened is, during the Biden administration, there was a break between Elon and the Democrats. He felt like he was almost pushed out of his party. It related to Tesla primarily. You know, the Biden administration, because he has said he wants to be the most pro-union president in history, Biden is very reliant on the United Auto Workers Union. And the United Auto Workers Union does not love Tesla because Tesla's factories are not unionized. So whenever Biden held electric vehicle summits or would praise other companies for moving to the transition away from fossil fuels, Elon Musk and Tesla were not invited or name-checked. And this really grated on the billionaire because, you know, his company has the primarily the biggest market share in the EV space. It felt like these personal slights. In addition to that, as Elon Musk's wealth grew, you know, he's the richest man in the world, the progressive wing of the party started villainizing him for wealth, for taxes, for, you know, income disparity in the country. And, you know, he started to move more to the right the last few years, culminating in this historic PAC that he helped form.
So can you talk about what Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his staff, when he was running for president, has to do with the new super PAC that Elon Musk is behind but doesn't want to be seen as behind?
Yeah, so when Elon started this super PAC in April, he started meeting with vendors in Austin, Texas, and he told them that he wanted to create this red wave of voters. And he started relying on these Texas-based advisors for this. More recently, just a few weeks ago, he brought in some of the team from Ron DeSantis's failed presidential bid. These are people from the campaign, but also Ron DeSantis's super PAC. He brought them in, and then right after he brought them in, we saw the vendors change at Elon's super PAC called the America PAC. And that's caused really big disruptions because the people that were hired to knock on doors in all these swing states were fired. The people that were hired to maintain the super PAC's website, to get forms out to prospective voters who wanted to register to vote, were fired. So those forms never went out. And there were other disruptions along the way, 90 days before the election starts. And some of the political operatives we've spoken to on the Republican side have worried that because this is such a big part of the GOP's efforts on Get Out the Vote, where you know, they think that the Democrats have historically been stronger, that this could cause some speed bumps along the way very close to the election.
So people who thought they were signing up to get ballots, they haven't gotten them?
Yeah, that's right. People that from swing states that put all of their information into the America PAC website were supposed to be mailed documents that they could then sign and send to their elected officials to register. What happened is the America PAC fired the vendor that was mailing out those forms a few days before they were about to send them. So those had not been mailed out yet. There's 8,500 of them.
Can you talk about the two investigations into America PAC, Dana?
Yeah, so that very issue has raised some alarm bells at some of the swing states, and they were worried that the America PAC was just collecting voter information under the guise of registering them to vote. But the full picture is a little bit more complicated. Had the vendors been able to stay on, the 8,500 people who put in their personal information would have received those forms. But it was really because the new people, leadership of the PAC came in and there was this disruption that last part of the cycle was not completed. Interestingly enough, the super PAC has had to rehire the vendor that it fired to complete that task.
How is Elon Musk hiding his name in the various PACs that he's supporting?
Yeah, what we've learned is really interesting. While Musk formed this PAC with a lot of his friends and cohort, he did not want to be the face of it, and he took pains to hide his involvement. You know, he has been on weekly one-hour phone calls with the vendors to get progress reports from them. He's very hands-on. He has asked them to show him the training materials for the door knockers. He's asked them to videotape what they say at the doors when they're knocking, right? So he's really keeping a very close look at how the progress of the PAC is, but he didn't want to be the face. So what he did was he assembled the PAC, and he assembled other donors to give checks of $500,000 or $1 million for the first quarter of expenses that appeared in, you know, July 15th federal campaign filings. with the intent of not donating himself the majority of the money for the PAC until July 1st or after, so that it wouldn't show up until the October 15th filings. What happened was we were able to get to the bottom of his involvement, and we reported these big stories about his involvement. And then there was a witch hunt within the PAC to see where the leaks came from. He was not very happy about that.
So if you can address, Dana Mattioli, what Elon Musk said about, well, you, the Wall Street Journal, denying that he's putting in $45 million a month. I think at the time it was 4 months, would be about $200 million into electing Donald Trump. He directly named the Wall Street Journal and saying it wasn't true.
He did. What we understand is he was really upset about the report coming out. Interestingly enough, before he denied it, he responded to someone on Twitter who said, who made the point that Elon went from voting for Obama to giving $180 million to Donald Trump, and that the Democrats must have screwed up pretty badly. And Elon confirmed that and said, yeah. And then after he started to deny the reports and walk back how much money he's giving, we have, you know, really stood by our reporting. He has told people around him that he would give around $45 million a month. You know, he obviously has the option to change his mind. Nothing's said and done until he writes those checks. But our understanding is, at the outset of this, he told them that he would fund the majority of the costs that were associated with the PAC, and that he has said that he would give $45 million a month.
Mm-hmm. And how is this all legal?
You know, this is the world of super political action committees. You know, this happens on both sides, I should say. There are super PACs on the Democratic side as well. And it's a way for billionaires to really pool their resources in major ways that are not allowed if you're just giving individual contributions to campaigns. And this is how a lot of the big money is funded when it gets to presidential elections.
And Trump, who has been attacking EVs, electric cars, for quite some time now, has flipped, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's definitely softened his stance since Elon has come out in full support of him. You know, Trump had been pretty critical of the EV sector. He's been known to be very close to big fossil fuel and the oil companies. And he's even come out and said that he has to be more supportive of electric vehicles because Elon has come out with such support of him. So that's like a really fascinating thing here as well. And they even spoke about it during the live stream, their differing opinions on fossil fuels, global warming, EVs, and, you know, there's definitely differing opinions there. But fascinating enough, even if you think about that, you know, Tesla, SpaceX, which Elon also owns and runs, these are both mission-based companies that would historically align more with Democratic causes.
I wanted to go back to the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. When Donald Trump called for UAW President Sean Fain to be fired.
United Auto Workers ought to be ashamed for allowing this to happen. And the leader of the United Auto Workers should be fired immediately. And every single auto worker, union and non-union, should be voting for Donald Trump, because we're going to bring back car manufacturing and we're going to bring it back fast.
So, Dana Mattioli, that was Donald Trump in his acceptance speech in Milwaukee, talking about Sean Fain, repeatedly saying his name, saying he should be fired. Now you have UAW President Sean Fain filing a labor relations complaint against Musk and Trump for saying that they were firing striking workers, or celebrating firing striking workers, which is illegal. Talk about Elon Musk and his relationship with UAW, and Donald Trump and his relationship with UAW and Sean Fain.
Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk has had a very, very contentious relationship with the United Auto Workers Union. Elon has been famously anti-union for Tesla. His Fremont factory, where these cars are assembled, is not unionized. And Elon has gotten to some hot water over the years about his comments about union activity at Tesla. And it's also the reason that he was on the outs, or is on the outs, with the Biden administration. You know, he's one of the only U.S. automakers that isn't a unionized shop, and he was ostracized because of that decision. So this is, you know, par for the course with friction between the union and Elon. What's interesting is the Republican Party has been trying to court union workers and is trying to make themselves look more pro-union. So we're seeing this confluence happening with what each party stands for and, like, some blurred lines there as well.
So let's stay at the Republican convention where we were broadcasting from in Milwaukee next week. Of course, we're headed to the Democratic convention. We'll be broadcasting from Chicago. But Teamsters President Sean O'Brien asked both conventions if he could address them. The Republican National Convention said yes. This is what Sean O'Brien had to say.
And here's another fact. Against gigantic multinational corporation, an individual worker has zero power. It's only when Americans band together in democratic unions that we win real improvements on wages, benefits, and working conditions. Companies like Amazon are bigger than most national economies.
So that's Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters. Dana Mattioli, you are the author of the new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Talk about what Sean O'Brien was talking about, and talk about Amazon when it comes to the Republicans, when it comes to the Democrats, when it comes to its power in the world.
I mean, Sean O'Brien is right. Amazon's sales are bigger than the GDPs of many nations. And my book chronicles its rise from unlikely successful garage startup to the most dominant force in American business history, almost like the equivalent of a modern-day Standard Oil. And the tactics it uses, illegal or unethical or anti-competitive, to put its finger on the scale and dominate industry after industry, and the effects that has on our economy, job creation, or, you know, losing jobs, bankruptcies, and innovation. And, you know, Amazon has had a really bumpy history with both the Republicans, specifically Donald Trump, and also the Democrats. You know, Biden has been really tough on Amazon. He put in place Lina Khan, the head of the Federal Trade Commission, the agency overseeing them, and she brought forward this historic monopoly lawsuit against the company last year. So they've had this scorched earth approach to government relations and public relations that has made enemies on both sides of the aisle.
And why did you decide to write an entire book on Amazon?
Yeah, I was the Wall Street Journal's mergers and acquisitions reporter. And in that role, I noticed over 6 years, CEOs of the retail companies in the beginning were nervous about Amazon. By the time I left the M&A job after 6 years, every CEO that I spoke to was nervous about Amazon. The industrial CEOs, the healthcare companies, the logistics companies. It was being invoked in every boardroom in corporate America as a source of fear. People thought it was going to eat their lunch and take their business. And I wanted to get to the bottom of how they penetrated industry after industry and became the top player, top one, two, or three player in like 12 different industries. And I set about investigating the company, and I found just a ton of business practices and driven by this toxic culture at Amazon, where the company lied, spied, cheated its way to the top. And I thought this book would be the perfect medium to bring light to those tactics, to show consumers, Americans, people around the world, why Amazon always seems to win. And oftentimes it's because it has its fingers on the scale.
And I want to talk about something that's been a controversy, someone who has become a controversy now with the Democrats. I want to ask you about the current Federal Trade Commission chair, Lina Khan, who you write about in your book on Amazon. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission in 17 states sued Amazon, saying it had illegally stifled competition. In May, Khan was asked about Amazon in an interview on ABC's This Week with Jonathan Coral.
You obviously made your name talking about the threat of Amazon as effectively a monopoly power. In what way is Amazon a monopoly? Because I can buy on Amazon, but I can also go down the street and I can buy at Walmart or I can buy at Target. I mean, how is Amazon a monopoly?
A few ways that we can tell that it's a monopoly is because it, too, is acting in ways that involve mistreating its customers. We've seen that the fees that it charges small businesses have dramatically increased over the last few years, so that now some small businesses have to pay $1 out of every $2 to Amazon. It's basically a 50% Amazon tax. Our lawsuit also alleges that Amazon has been using a whole set of secret algorithms to quietly raise prices for consumers. And so we allege that they've been able to get away with doing this through a whole set of illegal tactics that make it difficult for rival e-commerce websites to really stand up and enter the market and compete.
So that was Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan. Dana, your book opens with what one of your sources calls the most important law review article written in our lifetimes. That was a reference to an article Lina Khan wrote in 2017 headlined Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, which was published in the Yale Law Journal. Lina Khan argued Amazon is a monopoly that had, quote, evaded government scrutiny. Two major Democratic donors, media mogul Barry Diller and LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, have publicly called for Kamala Harris to fire FTC Chair Lina Khan, who has led Biden's antitrust efforts. That's if Kamala Harris becomes president. Hoffman sits on the board of Microsoft, which was sued by the FTC. Hoffman was recently interviewed by CNN's Jake Tapper.
Thanks for joining us. So you and other big money donors are giving money to Vice President Harris, suggesting also that she replace the head of the FTC, which impacts policy and the economy. What do you say to somebody who watches this and says, this isn't how American politics should work, rich people getting to buy levels of influence?
Well, I totally agree with not buying levels of influence. I separate my role as a donor and expert. So if you ask me as a donor, I say I'm giving money to Kamala Harris because I think she's the best future president for the U.S., for business, for a bunch of other things. If you ask me as an expert about what, you know, kind of Lina Khan is doing and whether I think she is helping or hurting America relative to your anti-merger policies, which are, you know, mostly to bring litigation versus, you know, really solidly grounded in kind of what's going on, what helps American business thrive here and overseas, then I give an expert opinion. But I think donor and expert should be kept separate. And I've never tied the two ever in any conversation anywhere I've ever had.
So that's billionaire donor Reid Hoffman, who has given $10 million to have Kamala Harris elected president. Your response and the significance of what's the pressure that's being brought right now around getting Lina Khan fired, Dana Mattioli?
Yeah, Lina Khan has become this lightning rod in CEO circles, but specifically in tech circles. We've seen CEOs and VCs become very frustrated with the FTC under Lina Khan because she's been very critical of them. She's taken a very close look at their companies. They've brought lawsuits against all big four tech companies between the DOJ and the FTC, as well as other companies. So it's not surprising. But Biden has been a staunch advocate of hers. The big question mark is what Kamala does if she were to become the president. Interestingly enough, this is another area where there's been some confluence. J.D. Vance is a big Lina Khan fan, as is Matt Gaetz. So there are some really rightward-leaning Republicans that are her fans. They call themselves the conservatives. So this is a very big question mark for whatever administration takes over as to the fate of Lina Khan and what that means for regulation at the antitrust levels.
And where do you see, what do you see as the fate of Amazon? I mean, there was just a massive Google lawsuit finding it is monopolistic. What about Amazon?
I would say that Google lawsuit from the DOJ, where the Department of Justice, you know, they won their case, that bodes really well for Amazon, which is being, you know, sued by the FTC. It won't go to court till 2026, so there's a lot of time in between now and then to see what would happen. But if Lina Khan and the FTC wins that case, it could have lasting effects for the company. It could mean a breakup in some ways of how Amazon works and whether, you know, its retail business is tied to its logistics arm or other areas that could be paired off. So this is something that could be really historic, depending on which way the dice roll.
And when you say it bodes really well for Amazon, you mean for the breakup of Amazon?
Well, it bodes really well for the FTC's case, I would say.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dana Mattioli, for joining us, author of the new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Dana's a senior reporter at The Wall Street Journal. We'll link to your article, Inside Elon Musk's Hands-On Push to Win 800,000 Voters for Trump. Coming up, the prominent Bethlehem Palestinian pastor, the Reverend Munther Isaac, joins us here in our New York studio. He'll be giving a major address tonight at the historic Riverside Church. Stay with us. Finding Strength Through Change by Lee Dines and the Jazz Tellers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza continues, with 36 Palestinians killed in the last 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Among those killed on Tuesday were two newborn twins, a boy and a girl. They were 4 days old. When their father went to register their births at a local government office, the home where they were sheltering near Deir al-Balah was bombed, killing the newborn twins, their mother and their grandmother. The Gaza Health Ministry says 115 newborns have been killed in Gaza since October. According to the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, out of nearly 17,000 Palestinian children killed by Israel in Gaza over the last 10 months, about 2,100, more than 2,000, were babies under the age of two. As we broadcast, nearly 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed since October, though the true casualty figure is likely far higher, with thousands of dead unaccounted for. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has issued additional evacuation orders for Khan Yunis. The vast majority of Gaza's population has been forcibly displaced, often multiple times. According to the UN, around 84% of Gaza's territory has been placed under evacuation orders by the Israeli military. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have raided towns and villages across the territory. In the northern town of Tamun, Israeli forces seized the bodies of four Palestinians killed in a drone strike. Over the past 10 months, Israeli forces have increasingly used aerial strikes in the occupied West Bank, a practice largely not seen in the territory since the end of the Second Intifada in 2005. In the South Hebron Hills, Israeli forces demolished six more homes of a Bedouin community in Masafriyata today. And in occupied Jerusalem, hundreds of Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for the second straight day under the protection of Israeli security forces. This all comes as the U.S. State Department announced Tuesday it's approved $20 billion in arms sales to Israel, including scores of fighter jets and advanced air-to-air missiles. In response to that announcement, our next guest, the prominent Palestinian Reverend Munther Isaac, posted on social media, quote, "The U.S. is funding the genocide. Faith leaders must speak up. Words of concern and void calls for peace are not enough. Speak truth to power. Silence is complicity. End quote. The Reverend Munther Isaac, a Palestinian Christian theologian, is the pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. He's in the United States on a speaking tour and will be giving an address tonight at the historic Riverside Church titled Silence is Complicity. The Reverend Munther Isaac joins us now in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
We spoke to you at Christmas time in Bethlehem, where you had set up this crèche scene, Christ in the Rubble. This is many, many months later. Talk about why you're in the United States, Reverend.
Well, I wish I was not here. I wish I was here in different circumstances. We're still calling for a ceasefire. And it feels like we're still calling for the world to humanize the people of Gaza, to humanize Palestinians. So I'm here to talk to faith leaders, and particularly church leaders, my own community, to speak louder. For it's been 10 months now since this war has broken. And we're tired of void calls for peace. We're tired of the same kind of discourse. And it's time that the voices of faith leaders, it must be heard, given that we are in the country that's funding this genocide, given that we are in the country that continues to give political cover to this war in Gaza. So if you're silent, knowing how your money is being spent, that means you approve. And so enough is enough. And I hope that more and more faith leaders, pastors, theologians, clergy, speak up more so that this tragedy in Gaza stops.
You know, yesterday we spoke with the Israeli peace negotiator, Daniel Levy. He was a negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers. And he criticized Zionist extremism and talked about what it means, what we're seeing now play out in Gaza. You're a reverend. If you can talk about the Christian Zionist evangelical community here, explain to people who they are and how much power they have.
Well, Christian Zionists are Christians who endorse the vision of Zionism of bringing Jews to Palestine. What many people don't realize is that Christian Zionists are actually far more in number than Jewish Zionists, and that Christian Zionism predates Jewish Zionism. Christians began dreaming of this concept of bringing Jews to Palestine long before the modern Zionist movement. And the idea was that Jews will someday be restored, using a theological term, which really means convert to Christianity, embrace Jesus as their Messiah. And for that to happen, they must be in Palestine, the biblical land. And many Christians would then add that for the second coming of Christ to happen, this must happen first. So they tied to the second coming of Christ. And today this movement has grown to become a very strong political force, giving millions of dollars and very much engaged in political lobbying on behalf of Israel. We have many congressmen and women actually repeat Christian Zionist phrases like, you have to bless Israel, Israel is chosen by God, it's a Christian commandment to support Israel. During the Trump presidency, Trump moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the American embassy, Trump said, and I quote, I did it for the evangelicals. So this is a very strong political force, which brings me back to what I was saying, that we can't be silenced when the Bible is weaponized right now to continue a genocide in the same way, because when we look at Zionism and Christian Zionism, in reality, they have contributed to the Nakba in 1948, to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, of Palestinians, many hundreds of thousands of refugees. Israel was not created on an empty land. And as a pastor, I question, where is the concept of peace and love and justice and compassion in all of this. It's shocking to us that many Christians don't see even the humanity of Palestinians because of this theology.
Have you spoken to the lobby group Christians United for Israel? It's one of the largest pro-Israel organizations in the United States, has something like 11 million members. The group's annual summit largely focuses on advocating for increased U.S. military aid to Israel.
I've never spoken to them directly. I don't think they would even recognize me as a Palestinian to speak to. It's a very extreme group. It's a very militarized group, and it's shocking to me again that such a thing exists in our Christian thinking, because Jesus is the antithetical of all of this. And the twisted irony in groups like Christians United for Israel is that in the end time scenarios that they fascinate about, they think of a scenario in which two-thirds, when the Jews gather in Palestine, two-thirds of them will be massacred in a big Armageddon type of war, and then the other third will convert to Christianity. And somehow this group is considered pro-Israel or, you know, fighting for the Jews, when, in essence, some of their views are truly anti-Semitic. And rather than channeling all of these efforts and movement into peace and coexistence between Palestinians and Israelis, they're promoting war, which again shocks me. So I hope they listen, but I also hope that people of good conscience in this country, faith leaders from different traditions, speak up against them. And many actually gathered outside of the meeting of Christians United for Israel to show their protest and to say, not in our name, and I'm very grateful for them.
Yes. Earlier this year, nearly 150 Mennonites were arrested on Capitol Hill in an act of peaceful civil disobedience as they called for immediate ceasefire in Gaza. So clearly, the Christian community is divided on this.
It's divided. In December, in the sermon I gave in Bethlehem, I said Gaza has become the moral compass of the world. Gaza has divided the world, not on the basis of religion or ethnicity or nationality, but really on moral, ethical grounds. And it has divided even many Christians. And I think that's a good thing, because we need to know where you stand. And we're certainly beginning to see many movements among faith leaders, among Christians. For the last months, many, many Christians are speaking up, conducting not just vigils, pilgrimages, walking in the street, demonstrating. As you said, some have been arrested. Even in the university encampments, I've seen many of my pastor friends are there supporting the students, which has actually been one of my messages, that we need to defend, support, and encourage those students and be with them. To me, that's where the street belongs, in the streets, where the church belongs. I mean, it belongs in the streets. So we're beginning to see a divide. But to be honest, by and large, the majority of faith leaders, Christian leaders in particular, are still silent or not strong enough in their calls for peace. Or, you know, the United States is still funding this war. You can't just call for peace. You need to call out your political leaders. You need to speak to them. You need to put pressure on them to say this is not ethical to continue to fund such a war, or to continue to give the political cover. So more is needed right now. I'm beginning to see some change, but with the urgency of the moment, the numbers of people being killed, 16,000, 17,000 are already children are being killed in this war. So we can't just resort to old calls, let's pray for peace and hope things get well.
Has the Jewish opposition to Israel's war on Gaza surprised you? The number of people in the United States, Jews who've been arrested, who've engaged in protest?
Yes and no. And I say no, because even before this war, there has been a divide. And actually, surveys showed that, ironically, support to Israel among white evangelicals have always been stronger in the United States than that of the Jewish community. And I also say no, because it's It's part of the Jewish faith and tradition to be for justice and you know, seeing the work with the civil rights in this country particularly. But yes, because it's really getting stronger and stronger. Groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace and Rabbis for Ceasefire, they're really speaking up and being well organized, and not just speaking, demonstrating. Many of them, I think, have been arrested. And I'm grateful for their clarity in their opposition to Zionism, because we need to call Zionism for what it truly is. And it's not just that they're standing for a ceasefire or peace right now, but they're clear in their diagnosis of the problem. The ideology of exclusion that Zionism is promoting and supremacy has to be called out. And I'm grateful that many Jewish groups in the United States now and around the world is speaking up against Zionism.
Can you leave us with a graphic picture of Bethlehem, with your hometown, a religious site for the entire world, what it looks like before you mentioned a divide, the divide right through Bethlehem itself, the physical wall?
Amy, for the first time in history, Bethlehem and Jerusalem are divided. Bethlehem has always been kind of the little sister of Jerusalem. I still remember vividly when I was a child, my mother used to take us to Jerusalem for shopping. It used to take us 15 minutes on a bus ride to get from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. Right now we're isolated. We can't get to Jerusalem. Bethlehem is a little town besieged by a wall and Israeli settlements, colonies. Suffocated in a very small area, and all the land, including the green area around us, is being confiscated by Israel, and it's out of reach to us, meaning we can't grow as a community, and we can't, you know, think of a future if there is nowhere else to go. They're clearly pushing us out of the country. And with the isolation from Bethlehem, and since October 7th, the restriction of movement even to other Palestinian towns, it truly feels like a city isolated. There's so much unemployment. And right now, all it takes for Israel is to close two checkpoints, and Bethlehem becomes another Gaza, another isolated block. This is true for other Palestinian blocks, towns, and villages.
We have 10 seconds.
So it is a really sad reality. And we're really anxious that this war in Gaza could expand to the West Bank.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Reverend Muntha Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. He's speaking tonight at the historic Riverside Church here in New York. His address titled, Silence is Complicity. That does it for our show. To see our podcast, video, and audio, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016. Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regimes scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of zero, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies.